are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend. Welcome to Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a program of author interviews and book reviews with a local perspective. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. Today, I'm very pleased to be talking with Tor Hansen. He is of the Puget Sound, lives on an island here, and this year he is going to be the 2018 Humanities Huntingford Lecture at the Jefferson County Library, for the Jefferson County Library. It's going to be held the last week in September this year. I believe it's on the 27th. And this is always an exciting event. And I think once you listen to Tor talking today, and if you have a chance to hear him anywhere else, you will be excited to come to Chimicum High School to hear him. So thank you so much for speaking with us today, Tor. Welcome.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me on.
That's great. I'd like to start with you reading just a short excerpt from your recent book, Buzz, The Nature and Necessity of Bees.
Sure, I've got something right here. Learning about bees may feel like something new, but the journey has less to do with discovery than rediscovery. People have always lived near them and among them. Only recently did we stop paying attention. Allowing bees back into our awareness rekindles old connections, and the results can be profound. I have a friend whose wife died young and unexpectedly, succumbing to a rare cancer mere weeks after feeling the first symptoms. She had been a beekeeper, and when he and his daughter returned home from the hospital, they found her hives in turmoil. The workers were busy tending new queen cells, and within a few days they swarmed, rising in their tens of thousands and massing on a maple branch 20 feet from the front door. He watched that swarm for hours and later wrote about the experience movingly, calling it, quote, magical, spiritual, otherworldly, and comforting. Though remarkable, this episode would once have seemed ordinary, even expected. Throughout Europe and North America, people used to follow a practice called telling the bees, keeping their hives up to date on all manner of news, from the state of their crops to births, weddings, or illness in the family. Whenever someone died, the bees would be soothed with singing, their hives draped in mourning black. Failure to do so risked offense, and everyone knew that resentful bees would soon swarm and depart. In that era, not so long ago, it was also common to take comfort in the presence of bees, a solace William Butler Yeats famously pined for in the Lake Isle of Innisfree. 9 bean rows will I have there, a hive for the honeybee, and live alone in the bee-loud glade, and I shall have some peace there. Wherever we find them, bees hum and bustle with the vitality of life itself, and while we may enjoy their honey and appreciate their role in pollination, our affinity for them is something more than practical.
Thank you very much, Tor. I think that sets the stage for me to let you know that not only is our author today a conservation biologist, but he is a great storyteller. And so you will learn amazing things when you read his books, and you will also be totally enthralled and, if I may say, a scientific page-turner. So we're going to be talking about Buzz today, but he has also written a wonderful book called The Triumph of Seeds, and he's also written Feathers, and a children's book called Bartholomew Quill, A Crow's Quest to Know Who He Is in the World, in the animal world. So, curiouser and curiouser, where did it all begin for you, Tor?
Well, I've always been a curious person. I think it really does boil down to that fundamental curiosity, which led me quite naturally to a career in science where asking questions is really the coin of the realm. It's a habit that all scientists have, questions leading to more questions. And then, quite naturally for me at least, from there on to writing books, where I really get to indulge myself by by diving deeply into these topics that fascinate me so much. And so it all boils down to curiosity. I'm driven by that fundamental question mark.
Well, I was struck by your stories of discovery, and a lot of them seem to happen in kind of a magical place called the Raccoon Shack. Can you tell our listeners something about what you have thought about or discovered at the Raccoon Shack?
I wonder if the Raccoon Shack would seem so magical if you knew I hadn't finished getting the siding on it. But at any rate, it's a project always in process down there. The Raccoon Shack is an old shack in our orchard that we named for its prior inhabitants, the raccoons who used to live in there and come out at night and steal the fruit. But not long after my son was born, I had been working in the house, and we realized that I needed a quieter place to work. So we kicked out the raccoons and ran a power line down to the Raccoon Shack, and I set up my office down there. So that is now where I work.
Mm-hmm. And so you've been there quite a while. And is this where these three books have kind of evolved? Did they happen all together or one at a time?
I take them one at a time, mm-hmm. and really get through one before I start in on the next one. So I have an endless list of possible books in my head, and then I narrow it down and do them one by one in a row. So yes, these are all products, more or less, of the Raccoon Shack.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get back to bees. I'll just be the 5-year-old in the corner and just ask you, what exactly is a bee? And how are they different from wasps?
Oh, this is a marvelous question, and there is an answer for this. There is an answer that is short and sweet, and that also really summarizes the key steps in bee evolution. You can remember what a bee is if you think of a bee as a hippie wasp. And I need to explain that a little bit, but the first thing to know is that wasps came first. They had been around for millions of years before bees came along. And the bees evolved from the wasps and still look quite a lot like them, which is why the two groups are so often confused. But if you are having a picnic and you find your insect attackers going after the fried chicken or stealing bits of bologna out of your sandwiches, then do not blame bees. The insects harassing you in that instance must surely be wasps, because wasps are basically carnivores. They are hunters and scavengers out scouring the landscape, constantly searching for other insects to hunt, or spiders, or scavenging bits of meat to take back to feed their babies, their larvae, back at the nest.
I think they like wine, too. I almost swallowed one the other day.
Yes, and they'll also look for bits of sweet things as well to fuel themselves. So they might end up in your soda can or your wine glass now and then. So the bees evolved a different habit. They evolved a vegetarian habit by switching from hunting to provisioning themselves and their babies solely from the products of flowers. And this all happened at a time when flowers were still, a bit rare in the landscape. This was back in the mid-Cretaceous period, about 120 million years ago, a time famously dominated by the dinosaurs, mm-hmm. but there was a lot of other stuff going on then as well. And the flowering plants were just beginning to spread and to diversify, and the bees, those young, new bees, took advantage of that resource. And soon their bodies and their habits began to change in adapting to that new vegetarian lifestyle. They grew longer hair that was feathery and branched for transporting pollen back to the nest, and they grew long tube-like tongues for accessing nectar deep in flowers. So if you think of them, remember that these are the hippie wasps. You then can remind yourself that these are the flower-loving, long-haired vegetarians.
All right. Let's hear it for the bees. And I have to say that you talk also about how bees and flowers kind of evolve together. Because when you talk about the long proboscis, we think about, you know, the lilies and all the different shapes of the flowers and colors that really came about because of bees, right? And, you know, in some ways.
Absolutely. A lot of what we take for granted when we look at a flower really boils down to the preferences of bees, in that there was this, you know, co-evolutionary connection made early on between bees and flowers that has persisted now for all of these millions of years. And the results can be seen all around us in the colors and the scents and even the shapes of many of our flowers. The blues and purples that we see in a bouquet are there primarily as attractors to bees. Those colors fall right in the middle of a bee's visual spectrum. Many of the golds and yellows are also very highly visible and attractive to bees. And it's possible that those colors wouldn't really be there in flowers if there hadn't been a necessity, really, to advertise for the services of bees as pollinators. Similarly, many of the odors that we find so beautiful in our floral arrangements are due to what is attractive to bees. There's a necessity then for flowers to produce these, what they call scent plumes, you know, these wonderful odors that drift on a breeze that help bees to locate and track down flowers, home in on them from great distances.
And
scent and even shape also are related to the bee visitors to the flowers, in that the banners of a pea flower or the lipped tube of a snapdragon really force bees to land in a specific way and enter the flower in a specific way so that pollen can be dabbed on particular bees of particular shape and size, all a result of this long co-evolutionary dance.
Well, here's another question. So bees all look basically the same, right? Black and yellow stripes, and that's how I identify a bee?
Oh, can I interrupt you there?
Yes,
yikes.
Please do.
Yikes. Oh, if we had our bee field guides open right now, you would see that bees can be every bit as diverse and as colorful as anything in a bird book. There are bees that are bright blue, bees that are iridescent and shiny, bees that are metallic and green, bees that have red fuzz. All manner of bees occur in the world. There are 20,000 species of bees buzzing around this planet. And they range in size from things the size of a pencil point to the Wallace's leafer bee of Indonesia, which is big enough to span your palm. So great diversity of bees resulted from that coevolution we were just talking about. And there's diversity on both sides of the equation. So great diversity of plants, but also a great diversity of the bees that visit them.
Well, I just recently came back from music camp, but you went to bee camp. And that was in Arizona. I was surprised about, you know, bees in Arizona. And you want to talk about a little bit about bee camp?
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, well, the bee camp, or the bee course, as it's called, is a wonderful annual event put on by the American Museum of Natural History. And it's competitive to get into this thing. They only have a few slots that are available. And you have to apply and justify your reason for being there, the research you're doing, or what have you. And they take their students and disappear into the desert for about 10 days, intensively studying bees and how to identify them and their behaviors and all sorts of things, with many of the top bee experts in North America show up to teach at this thing. It's become quite an institution. And it occurs in Arizona because that is, believe it or not, a place of incredible bee diversity. When we think about biodiversity in terrestrial habitats, we tend to think of, you know, tropical rainforests as the place with the most species. And overall, that's true. But bees like it dry. They like it dry and hot. And so while there are many bees in rainforests, just as there are in all sorts of other habitats that have flowers, the pinnacle of bee diversity occurs in desert or near-desert environments, places like Arizona, where they've identified more than 1,300 species of bees in that one state, or places like parts of South Africa with great bee diversity, or the dry Near East and Mediterranean regions that are desert-like or arid with shrublands. These places may only flower for brief periods of time, but they have a diversity of flowers. They have wonderful nesting habitat in a lot of bare open ground for the digging species and shrubs and other things for the twig nesters and cavity nesters. And then that arid, dry environment is really good for bees during the non-flowering period, when they're just tucked down in their nests, either in pupal form or hibernating in some fashion. The dry air is good for them because they don't tend to get the fungal diseases that afflict hibernating bees in wet parts of the world like where we live.
Well, I was, you know, curious about bees here in the Pacific Northwest, and you have a chapter called Keeping Dumbledores. Can you tell our audience about Dumbledores and here, especially on the Olympic Peninsula and out in the San Juans?
Absolutely, yes. The Dumbledore name comes to us not from Harry Potter books, but from a much older usage, and this is where J.K. Rowling got the idea. This is an old English word for bumblebee. People called them Dumbledores, and people in that era in these rural places were very familiar with their habits. And particularly children knew all about bumblebees and other kinds of native bees because in a time before the advent of refined sugar and easily accessible sweets at a candy store, kids would indulge their sweet tooth by going out and finding bumblebee nests, which are fairly gentle bees, and you can access the nest if you know how to find them and get a sweet treat in that way. Mm-hmm. Also, mason bees and other native bees that may not make honey but make a sweet combination of pollen and nectar for their offspring that goes by the charming name of bee bread, or in some cases bee pudding. So people knew all about these things, and when I decided to try my hand at beekeeping for the book, I decided to try to keep bumblebees rather than the honeybee, which is the common domestic bee. But I wanted to try something a little different. There's been so much attention given to honeybees, and I thought, well, why not try to keep these native bumblebees that we have nearby? So the chapter describes not only historic attempts to do so, but my own attempts on the porch of the raccoon shack,
yes,
aided by my young son, trying to get these bees to nest in old boots and teapots and anything else we could try to entice them into.
I'm going to watch my boots in the spring from now on. Will a shake dislodge them if they've already started nesting?
Yes, if you hear a buzzing from your rain boots, don't thrust your foot in there. There's something going on.
My garden boots, yes, that sit out on the porch all winter long. Well, what is it about, you know, bees? Why do we have this great affinity for them? Tell us a little bit about the history of early domestication and what's going on with humans and bees.
Sure. Well, nobody knows exactly when the first hive was or tamed, if you will, but we domesticated bees at least by the Middle Kingdom of Egypt 5,000 years ago, when we have good, clear, artistic depictions of beekeeping going on at that time, and these very sophisticated-looking clay hives that were ferried up and down the Nile in time with seasonal crops and wildflower blooms. So it's a very ancient art, and it's not surprising when you think about all the things that bees provided. They provided not only the sweetest thing in the diet, the honey, but also wax, which was an incredibly valuable item for production of light. Clean, burning, beautiful beeswax candles were our finest source of light for thousands of years. And also the wax was used in metal making and waterproofing and used in medicines. All of these various uses for the wax that in some cases made it as valuable or even more valuable than the honey. And on top of that, if that weren't enough, the honey itself not only could be, you know, spread on toast in the morning, but also in its fermented form provided mead, one of our earliest and most reliable sources of intoxication. So it's not surprising, really, then, that people domesticated bees before horses or camels or ducks or common crops like apples and oats and even coffee. Even our beloved morning cup of coffee came to us long after the bees. So we have a very ancient affinity for these creatures.
Well, your mention of coffee reminded me that we need to talk about the triumph of seeds as well today. And I want to tell our audience that you're listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. And this is Book Lovers Cafe. I'm talking today to Tor Hansen, and he's the author of Buzz, The Nature and Necessity of Bees, Feathers, Evolution of the Natural Miracle, and The Triumph of Seeds, How Grains, Nuts, Kernels, Pulses, and Pips Conquered the Plant Kingdom and Shaped Human History. So I see you're shortening up your titles, but I just want to say that by now, everyone knows that when you write a book, or I hope that they know, you're not just interviewing and gathering facts, but you're trying things out on your own. So tell us about what kinds of things you did at the Raccoon Shack to introduce yourself to seeds and especially the Mendel story. I like that.
Sure, yeah. Well, I am, you know, at heart and by training, really a field biologist, which in some at some level means I like to get my hands dirty. And that applies to writing books as well. When I get into one of these topics, I want to see how things work. And the lack of knowledge about how seeds work is part of why I wrote that book. I had done research on seeds and their dispersal and even their genetics. But at the end of all of that, after all of the scientific papers had been published, I realized I still had no idea what really went on inside a seed and what went on when you planted these things and how they sprouted and all sorts of things. So I tried a variety of experiments to see seeds in action, everything from the classic, you know, three toothpicks and an avocado pit and a glass of water experiment to watch.
You had a
sprout.
Dozen. You had a
yes.
Dozen.
And then also, I got interested, of course, in Gregor Mendel's famous experiment with pea plants, where he was looking at differences in the seeds to understand inheritance. You know, made this great intellectual leap in the mid-19th century that was ignored for decades until people finally caught up to mm-hmm. his line of thinking. But I wanted to see, you know, why was it really that leap was made with seeds, and what is it about the experiment that he performed that helped him to have such a great understanding? So I did my best to reenact, in a small way at least, the Mendel experiment by hand-pollinating pea plants in the little garden bed in front of my office and crossing wrinkled with smooth and doing a couple of generations of this and trying to see the same patterns of inheritance that he saw in those seeds, which worked, although I also learned that although it's not in the history books anywhere, I'm pretty sure that at the monastery where Mendel worked, they must have had a lot of cats capturing the rats that were running around, because I had a horrible problem of rats eating up my seed harvest before I could complete my experiment.
Yes, before the second year, you had to, fortunately, enough seeds were saved. But, you know, something, a story like that, that we've all studied and just take for granted, you brought it so to life. And I really appreciated that. And also, dormancy is something that's really important to seeds. And you told another story about Masada and, you know, the famous story of the Jews on top of the cliff and having to abandon it and commit suicide. But there's a seed story in there, which was incredible.
The seed story. Yes, there's a mini series from the 1980s, I believe, about the Masada story, but they don't get into the seed part of it in that particular production, so I had to pick up the slack there because it's one of the best seed stories around. Masada was this famous site, as you described, in modern day Israel, that was it was a fortress on top of this rocky spire, and there was a band of Jewish rebels there holding out against a Roman army that surrounded this place. And the Romans eventually built a ramp all the way up the side of this thing and ran their siege engines up there and breached it and took it over. But rather than surrendering to the Romans, the people inside committed mass suicide. And it has always been a very important cultural place to people in that area. So it's not surprising then that they did a massive archaeological dig there in the 1960s and uncovered all sorts of fantastic things, including a whole trove of dates, these wonderful Judean dates, which was the cash crop of Judea in the ancient world. They were famous. These dates were delicious. They were eaten by everyone from, you know, Emperor Augustus to Herod himself there in Judea. They're mentioned many times in texts of the era, but they had disappeared. No one was growing those for hundreds of years, that particular variety. So it was a really interesting thing to find that, in fact, here they were, so well preserved by that dry desert air that, you know, scraps of flesh could still be seen clinging to these pits. So the archaeologists, you know, put numbers on them and stuck them in a drawer somewhere. But some decades later, some botanists got a hold of these, or several of them at least, and decided to see if they could get them to sprout. So they planted them, fertilized them a bit, and lo and behold, one of them did indeed sprout and grow into a healthy Judean date palm after close to 2,000 years buried in the rubble at Masada. So it's currently the world record holder, if you will, for longevity in seeds, for how long a seed in the right conditions with the right kind of seed can last and still sprout. And they named that tree Methuselah for its great, great age.
Oh, that is just such an inspiring story. Well, I don't think we have time to talk about feathers, and it is equally as wonderful and fascinating a story from the archaeology of dinosaurs evolving and where exactly feathers came from. So I'm really recommending that book to all our listeners as well. And thank you so much. Oh, one more thing is I wanted you to say, if people want to read more about bees and especially about bee conservation, because we haven't talked about that, what would you recommend?
There is a wonderful conservation group called the Xerces Society, X-E-R-C-E-S, and they have a website that's just loaded with information about bee conservation and pollinators in general and insects and all sorts of things, with a lot of resources that you can download to improve bee habitat in your backyard and garden and that sort of thing. Wonderful group and a wonderful resource online.
That's great. That was just perfect. So thank you so much for joining us today, Tor. I've been talking to Tor Hansen. This is Book Lovers Cafe, and Tor is the author of many books, and he's also the Hunting for Lecturer this year, and he will be appearing in Port Townsend in September of 2018. He's a curious person, able to awaken the curiosity in us all. Go out and lay down in your garden and look, listen to the bees for a while. You'll discover something new. Thanks again, Tor.
Well, thanks for having me on, Chris. My pleasure.
Okay, you're welcome. And as Cicero said, if you have a garden and a library, you have everything you need. Join me next time for Book Lovers Cafe.